SiriusXM Sports presents
At the Races with Steve Bick.
Horse racing, handicapping, interviews. This is At the Races with Steve Bick.
A very good Wednesday, race fans. Sirius 219, XM 201, Sports on 964 if you're listening to Sirius XM online. And at the website, too, stevebick.com. Midweek here and inching toward opening day at Keeneland. They drew the Saturday card. Sure got people's appetites whetted for bluegrass and more. We'll look at that in a minute. And, of course, a holiday, nice holiday weekend on the horizon, which makes me realize that Tina's on vacation, I think, next week. So I be prepared for for those distractions. Yeah. You know, when there's somebody in the workspace that isn't normally there, she'll be. I wonder. She said, "Where can you take off?" She said. I said, "What do you mean? Can I take off?" She said, "Can you take off next week?" I said Tina. I said Saturday is the Wood Memorial, the Bluegrass, and the Santa Anita Derby, and next Saturday is the Arkansas Derby, and can I take off? No, I can't. Like crazy. And, you know, it'd be one thing if I met her over the winter. you would think she would, she would catch up on the uptake. because once in a while, the Easter week vacation of hers is, like the middle week in April, after, and I've said, I think I did say to her, we can go to Hot Springs. She said, I don't know. What am I going to do there? I said, well, I said, you can take the baseball, winter baseball, hot stove league tour. Huh? Huh? Who wouldn't love it, right? Come on, honey. I don't know. I I didn't know what else I could suggest for her. She could, she could hike the trails. I don't know. Although I could have checked with Hammer to see if if Gina was coming. Maybe that then. All right, Hammer. Let me know. Maybe we could still. I don't know. So no, honey, we're not. I'm not taking off the week of the week after the first Saturday in April. No. Of course, 2 o'clock today. They're going to send the horses through the ring at Fasig Tipton, Florida Sale, Gulfstream, and good luck to everybody: consigners, breeders, pinhookers, prospective owners. Looking forward to keeping tabs on what feels like should be a good sale, right? Let me clue you in on what should be a good show. I've got a visit with Alan Foreman coming up right at the first break, essentially. Ish, 9:15, 9:20, and we'll discuss two or three different things with Alan, as always. I mean, there's always a hat full of things to discuss with Alan, but the injury database news, which essentially dovetails into the work that Alan and the Mid-Atlantic partners have put together when it came to the strategic plan that we've talked about the last several years. And the strategic plan has really contributed mightily to, you know, the overall trend here. And I also, with Alan, will bring up, you hear me say this pretty regularly. This is, yes, it's good news. This is not something that can be merchandised or marketed. We're not drawing attention and pounding chest over lowering these numbers because you just have no control. You can only work around the elements and the atmosphere and the protocols and the habits and practices, and you just keep working at it and ingraining those habits and practices and driving it home and maintaining the surfaces with 24/7, you know, dutiful attention on all these topics, not just the surface, but it's a nonstop, ever vigilant mindset. And I know that in terms of fighting back against the critics of the sport, of equine sport in general, it's not limited to us and thoroughbred racing. You know, the eagerness to throw this in anybody's face, it's not worth it. It's not worth it because no matter how good these numbers get, no matter how much they keep improving, it's not going to, don't think it's going to satisfy those people because they want to ruin your livelihood. They want to end your career, your business, your lifestyle. That's their goal. Don't pretend that they're, they just want to see things as safe as possible. They don't want to see things safe as possible. They don't want to see any. They don't want to see anything. So don't try to, you know, use this as you know, some sort of a marketing gimmick. It doesn't work, and it, you know, it also opens us up to critique and criticism when there's spikes, because there's going to be spikes. You can't, no matter how attentive we are, there's going to be a bad summer, a bad winter, a bad 6 weeks, whatever it is. No matter what we do. So I nice to make note of this and talk about what is working and what can still be enhanced, but really it's cautionary to pound the chest and feel all proud. Shouldn't feel proud about, you know, doing what is necessary and what is incumbent upon the care and maintenance of equine athletes, so, and those that ride them in competition and in training. So that's my cautionary position when it comes to this. But it's very encouraging, and it's very satisfying to see that the things that people are working so hard at are able to be quantified in this way. So also with Alan, there's going to be, I mentioned yesterday, regarding his visit, there's going to be a modified and modest version of the match series later this summer and early fall. So that's nice. And Alan will provide those details. And, you know, with Alan's visit, it's hard not to discuss HESA with him. You know, last week, or now I guess it's 10 days ago, we had the conversation regarding the HPPA and their lawsuit, and Alan and the the HRA, the TRA people, they did not participate. And there, you know, there's been widespread criticism of the horsemen that you know, have taken this position. And I want Alan to juxtapose TRA members and you know, because obviously they, you know, they discussed it and had the opportunity to join that lawsuit. And we'll let Alan discuss, because certainly Alan, through the many introductions of versions of HESA, was opposed and then either relented or was satisfied with provisions or just accepted the inevitability of it. I haven't had this conversation on air with Alan, so we'll let him talk about it. You know, the concerns remain endorsing an entity that is completely completely without definition and not knowing who will be involved or how it's going to be paid for. If you can't understand concerns of that nature, it's and as I've said for 2 weeks, the demonization of horsemen that are asking these questions is completely ill-conceived and unwarranted. So, looking forward, as always, to talking to Alan. And there's a couple other things, actually. There's a story that has been sitting on the desk, and I did some desk clearing this morning. There was a story from late February that I have not had a chance to pursue and to get more information about. And it came out of University of Pennsylvania, the School of Veterinary Medicine, which, of course, is, you know, one of the leading vet enterprises in education. And they have developed a test to detect gene doping in horses. And this, for whatever reason, this has not gotten nearly as much. You know, when I printed the thing out, I expected it would get, you know, it'd catch a wave and would be widely hailed and widely anticipated. And I haven't, I literally have seen not one reaction to it. And I've sort of piled it and put it in with some of the stuff that I typically discuss with Alan and, of course, his work, too, with RMTC, et cetera. So I'm going to slip that in. Alan, if you're listening, in anticipation, there's a question that we had not discussed. We're also going to hear today. It's Tuesday or Wednesday. My God. Wednesday. So 10 o'clock, Sire Watch Pedigree Focus, brought to you by Hill and Dale, and a lot to discuss with Sid. We'll interrupt his work with son Joe down in Tampa, and we'll talk about Known Agenda, certainly, and certainly, you know, feels, especially after we talked to Todd yesterday, you know, feels like a horse that is going to be, depending on what happens these next 2 weekends, it feels like a horse that, you know, comes in the way successful Derby runners from the Todd Pletcher barn have come in to Derby. So we'll let Sid riff on his pedigree. We'll also, might as well, you know, I know that Like the King and Horses Off the Synthetic, you know, mid-80s buyer doesn't feel like the King is a major candidate. But he's by Palace Malice, who, by the way, is son of Curlin, so there's a lot of Curlin in the conversation. And of course, the role of Palace Malice in his Derby, it was such a crazy story, as you recall the way things kind of went awry. He obviously righted the ship later, but Palace Malice's own Derby exploits. interesting in themselves. And then also, I don't know if we've got to worry too much about the horse that won in Dubai, but can't hurt to just touch on him. And we'll see. We'll see if Sid's got any thoughts about the bluegrass. And while we're at that point, and of course, hour three, we'll get visiting. I'll get visiting with Papa probably today, and we'll handicap a little something. Craig Griffin and I will reach out to closing week at Sam Houston. And if you haven't looked at these next four cards at Sam Houston, they're eye popping. Virtually, full fields, race after race after race today through Saturday. So a big finish to the Sam Houston season. And it's been, obviously, it's been a smashing success as we've discussed with Craig and with Frank Hopf and with Nick Tamrook. Nick's doing the morning line and is part of the group, but they've had just a fabulous meet. So we'll get to Craig and Seth. We'll get Seth Merrow and commiserate with his SU orange men. I almost tweeted yesterday something. You remember last Wednesday we talked about. Boeheim. The whole thing came up with when I was sports writing at the Oneida Daily Dispatch, and he asked me about Boeheim, and I said he was just a miserable, just a prick. I mean, ridiculous. And then yesterday there was the big uproar, and I started to tweet. I mean, it's 100% comedy. What people are just discovering how awful he is now at this late date. You've had 40 years to determine how awful he is. Pretty funny. The bluegrass. Let's get you caught up. And the bluegrass ended up with everybody that seemed headed here. Rudy Brissett pulled up the concept of running Tarantino off of the fiasco at Turfway, where basically he got left and then sort of jogged around and didn't participate. But now the cooler heads prevailed, and Tarantino did not get entered. The field comes together this way with Hidden Stash on the rail for Vicky Oliver and Bayerano, coming after the nice performance at Tampa. And Vicky Oliver at Keeneland is everybody's favorite Vicky Oliver. Vicky Oliver, if you carved out stats, her work at Keeneland is completely, it's like she doesn't really care about anything else except the two meets at Keeneland. That's, which is not true, of course, but it to some degree, I mean, her best work comes at Keeneland. She points for Keeneland, and a big opportunity for Hidden Stash to parlay the Tampa Bay Derby placement into, he could, with a forward move, certainly, figure wise, he would be a little interesting as a middle priced long shot in the Derby. And I'll tell you why. He's got something that old school figure watchers. And if I'm not mistaken, it was Davidowitz who wrote about this in Betting Thoroughbreds. Healthy 2 and 3 year old development. Fall of 2-year-old year, winter 3-year-old year, spring 3-year-old year, that these horses, the healthiest development pattern is a performance and then the pairing up of a performance, and then a forward move and a pairing up of that performance, and then a forward move and a pairing up. Well, Hidden Stash has got about as healthy a development pattern as you could ever, ever look at. If you want to see what that pattern looks like, all you got to do is look at this horse. Two sprints, 64 buyers in both. She stretches him out at Keeneland. Winner, 74 buyer. Comes back at Churchill in November on the Stars of Tomorrow 2 card and wins the allowance. Puts him away for the winter. I mean, you want to talk kick it old school. Brings him back in the Sam Davis. Moves forward to an 83 buyer, third behind Nova Rags and Candyman Rocket, and then the Tampa Bay Derby, second beaten less than a length. Pair of 83 buyers. This is about as beautiful a pattern, you know, just using buyers, as you'll ever, ever see. So Hidden Stash, it has not, as they say, you know, as Jerry Brown, for instance, Thorograph says, hasn't gone backwards yet. And the spacing is like idyllic. He's interesting. Untreated. And Todd, I'm surprised Todd didn't bring him up, but Andy brought him up yesterday. And, you know, whoop, there he is entering the Bluegrass off the maiden win. Seems a little ambitious, but, you know, Team Valor, why not? Take a spin and you get a shot, and you can't blame him. Joel Rosario, as I like to write, sees fit to ride. Highly motivated, Chad Brown pointed for this out of the Gotham, and also, you know, two healthy, you know, very healthy two-year-old development, comes back in the Gotham, you know, feels like a great landing spot from the first start of the year, and now, you know, anticipate a next step forward. Lot to like about the Clarovich homebred too, and you know, certainly for Klarman, who has, you know, had so much success, and I'm sure he's excited to have a homebred be in this position. Essential quality, needs no introduction, and was made 3-5, you know what, with good reason. So, and we'll talk about the pace in a second. Ron Bauer for the Fradkins, and certainly rooting for their homebred, John and Diane Fradkin, who were a lot of fun, that involved in social media, and you know, just clearly just love the game and being involved. This out of a cowboy cow mare of theirs, Cashmere, a Twirling Candy, and has made steady progress himself. And you know, you know, the two dirt races, the American Pharoah and the, you know, and the Breeders' Cup, were not terrible. I mean, the one question you have a little bit with him is you wonder if he's a horse that doesn't appreciate the kickback, and you know, that's, you know, that a lot of times with turf horses, it's not so much that they can't get over dirt. They don't like the kickback, and you move them to the turf because they don't have to deal with as much, you know, flying into their face. So Ron Bauer, you know, certainly has run competitively against, you know, everything that he's been facing. LeBlanc in here for Paulo Lobo, a broken Valcote. Broke his maiden at Churchill in November, had a little bit of a tune-up at Oaklawn and an allowance, ran okay. Twilight Blue, who's a nice horse. Hush of a Storm, last-minute maneuver by Bill Maury to show up in here and you know, get him back on the dirt. His one dirt try at Churchill last November was, you know, but it was a debut, so you just don't know. But then he moved to Turfway for the winter and, you know, went on a nice run. So it's an acid test for dirt for Hush of a Storm. Sitting on Go, who everybody just is curious why Dale is continuing to pursue this avenue when he just has not run well going two turns and you know, since the Iroquois win. and he's going to give it one more shot. And then I suppose if it doesn't go well, he'll look to turn him back, which everybody has been calling for. But I, you know, Dale, there's an obvious reason that he. I mean, the obvious reason is there's only one set of American Classic races. And finally, keep me in mind, who's had you know, a difficult time of it in terms of the way the weather and the way things that transpired in over the winter in terms of getting his season going. He draws widest. Davey Cohen, of course, comes to ride. I didn't mention this. Lannery aboard Sitting on Go. Gonzalez, Hush of a Storm. Jimenez for LeBlanc. Florent Giroux gets a first try on Ron Bauer. Luis Saez, obviously, on Essential Quality. Javier back, you know, stays with Highly Motivated. And I told you Rosario and Bayerano on Untreated and Hidden Stash. There you go. There is your bluegrass, and it's you know, it's a nice, a typical bluegrass day card, the Shakertown and whatnot. The Ashland came up only with six, you know, Simply Ravishing leading that group. But pass the champagne for George Weaver. Don't forget about that flatter filly and that moon swag that we talked about with Ian Wilkes, Malathat. With from Shadwell, the $1 million Curlin filly, last seen winning the Demoiselle. She's perfect. I mean, everybody's kind of waiting for her to show up. And Will's Secret comes back here, too. The Honeybee winner for Dallas and Mr. Horton, the Willis Horton homebred. Really a homebred out of the Giants Causeway Mare. Girl's Secret by Will Take Charge. So. That one's got Mr. Horton stamped all over it. Plenty more to talk about, obviously, with the you got the Transylvania and the Beaumont tomorrow kicking off the season, and more that turf sprint as well on the card. Nice start the first couple of days. There's also 2-year-old racing, of course, kicking off at Keeneland tomorrow. Races 1 and 3 are your. Are your 2-year-old season starters, and glancing at this to see if we've got any first crop sires that are going to get their first runners climped. Baytown Valley Girl, Paul McEntee, qualifies under that scenario. And who else? Let's see. Mastery, Jim Chapman's got one that... Macmer Hall bred. There's another climped in the third, Marlon Key. And another climped, John Ennis has got one, Woods Edge bred. And there you go. So we got some early reads with the 2-year-olds breaking camp early here in well, it'll be April tomorrow, right? So it's April 1st as of tomorrow. Let's reach for Alan. I went 5 minutes longer than I expected. So we'll get Alan Foreman in here and have that discussion. And we'll get going. All right. Let me see what else I got on the desk while we're, you have no idea. I must have, one thing that'll make Tina proud is I was able to purge, I was able to purge a pile of stuff because it was getting the PPs and the charts. They were starting to encroach on my seating area here in the office. I'm very tactical when it comes to the photos I put up. I really have not shown what a fiasco this is. Truth be told, Alan Foreman joins us. Good morning.
Morning, Steve. How are you?
Excellent, excellent. Good Pesach to you and the family, first of all.
Thank you.
Alan, the equine injury database, which of course now has got 12 years of history assembled, and this has been it's been important because these kinds of records had not been kept previously, and so now there's a quantifiable way to you know, view the efforts to improve safety. And, you know, the number in terms of catastrophic incidents per 1,000 starts drops to the lowest level since records have started to been kept. Your thoughts about the report?
I'm not surprised. It's always a good news story when you see a decline in the number of fatalities. And it mirrors what we've been doing in the Mid-Atlantic, which is why I'm not surprised. The Mid-Atlantic tracks all participate in the EID. We've all seen declines, substantial declines. We've had a 43% decline in fatalities in the Mid-Atlantic since we started getting the statistics together in 2010. And actually, there's been even a greater drop since after the rash of fatalities and the issuance of the New York Task Force report on racehorse health and safety in 2012. And it just demonstrates that the strategies that we are employing in the industry to make our racing safer for our equine athletes and our attention to the health, safety, and welfare of the horse are working and are successfully working. And it's a positive trend that obviously we're going to be very diligent and vigilant in ensuring that that pace continues.
When you look at these numbers, and I'm reaching for Dr. Parkin to provide the the epidemiology portion of this, but what is most striking to you, and what are also areas that you note need continued improvement or maybe special attention?
Well, we see declines in each of the jurisdictions, which again points to adherence to, attention to, and a willingness to participate in the numerous reforms that we've been implementing in the industry, whether it's medication, pre-race examinations, targeting horses that have been off for a long period of time, looking at the numerous risk factors that have been identified in warranting a closer look at horses that are going to the starting gate. I think one of the things that stood out from, you look at 2020 was a COVID year, and you'd say to yourself, well, what effect does COVID have? Does the fact that there was a shutdown in racing for a period of time alter the statistics because you've got fewer starts? Well, you could say yes, but since we're basing the numbers on per 1,000 starts, that doesn't exactly explain that. What we did see and what Dr. Palmer indicated and what shows in the EID statistics was there was an increase in fatalities in two-year-olds. And Dr. Scott Palmer, who's the equine medical director in New York, who really just is so data-driven and has spent a considerable period of time trying to examine the phenomenon of why that was the case, believes that COVID was a novel risk factor in 2020 because it interrupted the training patterns, particularly for the two-year-olds. We had owners who took these young horses potentially off the track back to the farms, brought them back. They didn't train as they normally would. These are horses that are developing, and when their training pattern is interrupted and their bones have not, are continuing to form, it puts them at increased risk. It's not something that we saw coming, but it's something that we learned as a result. And so I think the increase in fatalities in two-year-olds was something that stood out in 2020. And as we see these risk factors, we start to implement strategies to see that that gets reduced or eliminated going forward. And hopefully, we'll see the difference in 2021 as this year goes forward. But what you're seeing is, particularly among the tracks that have, and horsemen and veterinarians and regulators that have bought into plans like the Mid-Atlantic Strategic Plan, they are having a marked effect on the overall statistical data that we're getting, and it's something that we're all learning from, and it's a good news story for the industry. It kind of, like everything else, the good news gets buried, and a lot of people haven't seen it and didn't get the kind of attention that I think it deserves, but it's a very important very important report that we've just gotten.
A couple of things. You mentioned about the reporting tracks. I mean, how significant do we believe those that are not participating? What can be done to get, you know, universal cooperation involved?
Well, I'll answer your second question. HISA, I think, is going to solve that problem, because I suspect that one of the requirements of HISA, because HISA has two programs. One is the anti-doping and medication and drug testing program, and the other is the safety and welfare program. And the safety and welfare program, essentially up until this point, has been the NTRA's a program on racetrack safety, the safety and integrity program. That is a voluntary program. The EID program is a voluntary program, and I would expect that participation in the EID is going to be a requirement for all racetracks. And it isn't just reporting the statistics to the EID. It's allowing those statistics to be published so that everyone can see what your fatality rate is and what your data looks like. And so you can not only draw conclusions from it, but I think there's a peer element to it. We certainly have found that to be the case in the Mid-Atlantic, and that drives everybody to want to buy into the reforms and improve what they're doing.
And on that topic, if you, and I'm sure you don't mind discussing it, flesh out, Alan, some of the strategic plan initiatives and executions when it's come and how it's impacted, and specific changes in, I use the term habit and practice as kind of a moniker for this. I mean, what has changed specifically, and what has been most successful, and do you think, whether it's anecdotal or if there is any numeric support, what has been most impactful?
Well, we don't operate anecdotally in the Mid-Atlantic. We are the Mid-Atlantic strategic plan is a data-driven plan with specific measurements to determine not only compliance, but we learn from what we're doing, our strategies, our identification of risk factors, whether it's working or it's not working, and it gives us something to measure year by year, and it's something that we've implemented is not working, we can refine it. If it is working and somebody isn't doing it, there's pressure for that track or group to implement. But I will tell you, without question, and I know Scott Palmer agrees with me, a number of experts I've talked to, and I'm going to talk about this at the National Equine Law Conference at the end of April in Lexington, is we've seen a change in culture. We've seen a significant cultural change, not only with respect to commitment to the health, safety, and welfare of the horse, but in the area of medication. I've seen over the past 5 years the biggest decline in not only the usage of medication, but medication positives in the Mid-Atlantic region since we've been looking at this data. And it mirrors the decline in the fatalities. Not that the two are necessarily directly related. It's certainly one component. But I can tell you, because the equine medical directors and the veterinarians who conduct the pre-race examinations all universally agree that when we went a year ago to the restriction on non-steroidals within 48 hours of a race and 14 days on the corticosteroids, they felt that they had a better opportunity to examine the horses. They were sending sounder horses to the starting gate, and they felt that the care and the training of these horses was not compromised by these rules, but they were sending fitter horses to the starting gate and allowing them to start. That has been one of the most significant changes. But we've got committees in the region comprised of veterinarians, of horsemen, of regulators, of track operators in so many different areas, from protocols for pre-race examinations, mortality review boards. We look at every fatality. We try to get to the bottom of why a fatality occurred and could it have been prevented. We learn from that. We share information. We collate information. We're now working on a continuing education program for the region that will be implemented this year. I think anybody who takes a look at the Mid-Atlantic Strategic Plan and sees the level and volume of work that this region has done over the past 3 years, it's pretty staggering. And I think Dr. Parkin would tell you when you even a modest decline in fatality rate is very significant. It may not look so in statistics if you go from 1.41 to 1.39, but that's a very significant number in the statistical analysis and the epidemiology of looking at the phenomenon of fatalities. And I think Dr. Parkin would tell you that what's been going on here has been very important to the industry, and it's something that everybody should be doing. And I think under HISA, that's what will be happening.
Well, the other specifics people should note, no real surprise in terms of the rates. Dirt is less safe, obviously, than turf and synthetic. Synthetic remains a pace setter, and an obvious benefit. The challenges of marketing it successfully is a much more involved topic. I will say though that we have had news. We've got what? We've got Gulfstream is going to add one to replace one of their turf courses. There's the potential in New York considering the addition of a synthetic. So it's not as if it's not as if it's a complete stalemate when it comes to widening the influence of synthetic surfaces. Sprints are there's no news here either. Sprints sure. More dangerous than middle distance and routes. The older the horses as they become more mature and reach maturity four and over, obviously they're if they're sound enough to keep racing, they're safer. A lot of the things that we already know got reinforced.
That's it. It reinforces what we already know. It was conclusions that we drew in the task force report we did in 2012. We've continued to look at that. It's on the list of potential risk factors. Two things with respect to the Tapeta surface. There have been conversations in the industry that maybe we ought to just get off with dirt and just require Tapeta surfaces, and then you have your turf courses. And I suspect that that's a conversation that will take place going forward under the new authority. We will have the option of the three surfaces in Maryland when the redevelopment plan is completed. Gulfstream's looking at it. New York has been looking at it for quite some time. And I think it certainly presents an opportunity. But the other thing is that, and it was, I think, recommended by Dr. Parkin, and it's in the EID report that was issued by the Jockey Club, is racetrack management systems. The work with Dr. McPeterson, working with the track superintendents. We're trying to do the same thing in the Mid-Atlantic, trying to get the track superintendents to work together to take a look at variations in surfaces, training methods. We're talking about, maybe if you just take an extra break in the morning during training, that can have a positive effect on injuries during morning workouts. And we're going to start focusing in 2021 on strategies to employ during morning training sessions. So, there's plenty of fertile ground there, particularly when it relates to track surfaces.
We'll monitor and we'll report as we as we will. And I'll I'm looking forward to getting Dr. Parkin on. I haven't talked to him on air in forever.
Oh, he's terrific.
Yeah.
I mean, he is just an incredible resource. He's a brilliant guy, he's just a great resource for the industry.
And is, you know, having, you know, somebody consistent, kind of looking at these, you know, that goes a long way too. I mean, having continuity and, you know, the ability to, you know, to have these records. I mean, the fact that these weren't being kept, you know, going back, you know, before 2009, you know, there was no way to even know how much progress there had been actually, because we didn't know, you know, what the numbers were. So, frankly, just the fact that this was created was a groundbreaking and monumental achievement. Start paying attention.
Very cool, and the jockey club, just terrific.
Alan, you hinted at a couple of things that I was going to follow up with you, and we have not really had a full-fledged conversation, and we don't necessarily have to have it right now, regarding your shift into support of HISA and its role in long-term direction for the game. We've seen here the last few weeks since the HBPA's filing of the lawsuit. I see, you know, it's one thing to have somebody like Graham Motion thoughtfully address the topic. Then it's another thing to have, you know, wild pot shots being haymakers taken at HBPA. Explain from, you know, for you and your constituents at TRA, why you didn't participate, and, you know, where your thoughts are currently regarding HISA and what the next steps are going to be and what we can expect.
So we've been in this very divisive debate in the industry for the better part of the last 7 or 8 years on whether federal intervention of some kind is necessary in order to address both the integrity issues in our sport, primarily medication and safety and welfare issues. And I opposed, and we opposed, the original Horse Racing Integrity Act that with three or four different iterations in Congress. I was invited to testify and testified against that legislation in 2018. But at the same time, I was working with a small group of industry leaders to try to find a pathway out of this divisive debate. And more importantly, to me, it wasn't a positive test in racehorses that was destroying the industry. It was horses that were dying on the racetrack. And I became concerned with both the closing of the circuits and with SeaWorld that the public was just laser focused on our fatality rate and the fact that horses were dying on the racetrack. And that was just unacceptable. It's a different generation today. And so I said to the NTRA board, it's the one place where you get all the industry leaders together, that while I oppose the original Horse Racing Integrity Act, I could support federally mandated standards for safety and welfare, very similar to what we're doing in the Mid-Atlantic. Because what was hurting us was that everything we were doing was voluntary. So it didn't matter how effective our strategies were. If one jurisdiction didn't want to do it and didn't want to play ball, then, you know, where are you? And this whole issue of uniformity was a continuing problem. And I, you know, both working through the Mid-Atlantic work, seeing what happened at Santa Anita, and I think I had been on your show and talked about it, had developed a compact for all the jurisdictions to do essentially what HISA does, but do it through a compact.
Right.
And we were moving along successfully, and then we had industry groups in some states that said no. The standardbred industry said no, and we're going to block you thoroughbreds from doing it because we're afraid if you do it, then they're going to turn to us and they're going to require us to do it. And I couldn't get it done. I mean, we got legislatures to pass it, and we were moving forward, but I couldn't get it done. And so at some point, you throw up your hands and you say, if the industry isn't willing to do it on its own, then there has to be some mechanism to accomplish it. And so, you know, I sat at the table with a number of other industry leaders and said, okay, how do we put something together that would require everybody to do it? We continue to regulate ourselves, but we mandate safety and welfare standards that everybody has to adhere to. And that led to hiring very sophisticated legal counsel to help us design this and tell us how to do it. Now, the rub is always Lasix, and that's certainly a big issue for me representing horsemen as it is for any other horsemen's organization. But I had I have a very diverse membership, and I have a number of members who were willing to look at change in Lasix policy. I had those who didn't want to hear about any changes, and I still feel very strongly about the safety and efficacy of Lasix. But I wasn't part of that settlement. That was done by another group. And I don't think the legislation was going to rise or fall on whether or not I opposed the bill because I didn't like the Lasix provisions. But I was at the table. I helped to develop the HISA plan. I committed that if you mandated safety and welfare standards and did it in a way that we could safely continue to self-regulate, that we could support that. And I've got members of my organization who aren't real happy, and I've got members who are thrilled with this. And so I took the position, and certainly we, that this is the better path going forward and may even be necessary. I think it's given cover to those who are being jurisdictions like Pennsylvania, for example, being criticized for their safety and welfare protocols and their statistics. It's been very helpful in Maryland in talking to the Maryland legislature. I mean, there are concerns everywhere about fatalities and the safety and welfare of our horses and how we're caring for them. The medication scandal, the Navarro service, was a real gut punch for the industry. That really shook things up too. And I just think that it was time for a major change, and we need to be part of that solution. We need to be at the table. The status quo simply will not cut it anymore.
Well, which is not really a point I would argue with. You're too practical, Alan, to not acknowledge the open-ended elements of where this stands. The potential the potential for the control of this, number one, to be in a very narrow group of hands, dictating to the rest of the industry, whatever they deem appropriate, that is a specter in itself. And at some point, we're going to be informed of how this is going to be paid for. How do you create an entity like this and then fill in these blanks afterward?
Well, look, I think that to me, and I think others, the primary consideration of HISA is that it's going to create one set of standards that everyone's going to have to adhere to. Let's use that as a starting point, okay? And that's what the compact would have done. The rulemaking that will be done by the authority will be under the Federal Administrative Procedures Act, which means that if and when the authority wants to adopt the rule, it's going to have to propose it. It's going to have to allow for public comment, perhaps a hearing. It will take that information into consideration. They'll either revise the rule, scrap the rule, or adopt the rule. And when they do so, and they set a final enactment date, that'll be a final enactment date for everyone. And when it relates to medication policy, for example, putting Lasix aside, that's already been baked into the statute. what I think they're going to propose is very similar, if not identical, to what we're already doing in the Mid-Atlantic and a number of jurisdictions are already doing. The change is going to occur in jurisdictions where the regulator, the horseman, whomever, didn't want to implement those changes. Status quo, okay? With respect to safety and welfare standards, they're probably going to mirror a lot of the work that we're doing in the Mid-Atlantic, what the Thoroughbred Safety Coalition has proposed, and the NTRA's safety and integrity program. So I don't think there's going to be a heavy lift there. But when changes are necessary, it's going to go through this system. Now, look, I'm the first one to tell you, the leadership wanted independence. They didn't want industry people beholden to some constituent group, and I don't care who it is, running this operation and running this authority. And so they're going to be primarily independent. And our job as an industry, I know what my job is going to be through my work with the THA and the Mid-Atlantic, is to educate them and to advocate for what I think is best for our industry and best for our horses. And look, I can't tell you that I'm going to walk into a wall of individuals who were pre-picked with preconceived notions. I hope that's not the case, and I don't think that's going to be the case, but I'm optimistic about that. I don't necessarily share the view that this is going to be a bunch of handpicked people that were already selected who've got a specific agenda that they've been handed, and that's the way things are going to go forward. With respect to funding, I suspect what's going to happen here, there's no question funding is a massive concern to everyone in the industry. It can be a tipping point for some racetracks, for example. The unknown isn't helpful, but I'm just giving you my own personal view. What I think is going to happen is that there is going to be, I think the current system that we have is going to be superimposed into what HISA is, and they are going to be looking for consolidation of they're going to be looking for consolidation of and efficiencies in the way we're doing things that will not necessarily result in additional costs. And I said when this effort started, if it meant a $1 per start charge for every start for every owner and trainer towards what we would call an integrity fee to help pay for this program, I'd be willing to do that as our part of our contribution to this effort. And the tracks should be required to. Other industry constituencies should be required to. And I think if they're reasonable about it, and I think they're going to be aware of the financial constraints that are clearly evident here, I think we'll be okay. But we're not going to know that. And I think that for those who are challenging the concept and the statute now, I think they're being premature. If this doesn't work out, there'll be plenty of opportunities for litigation. But I don't think now is the time to challenge.
You do have HBPAs that are part of TRA.
THA,
excuse me.
Yeah.
Are they, and how do they fit into this equation?
We have HBPAs that are part of the Mid-Atlantic Strategic Plan. They are not part of the THA. The Pennsylvania HBPA is Penn National. The Pennsylvania THA are the horsemen at parks who support, our effort moving forward. I can't speak to the horsemen at Penn National. They have been active and willing participants in the Mid-Atlantic Strategic Plan. I mean, I've worked with Todd Mostoller for years, and he's terrific to work with. I have never talked to them about their litigation or whatever. I just know they've been 100% supportive of the Mid-Atlantic Strategic Plan. They have never tried to block any of the initiatives. They've all been implemented in Pennsylvania, and I think the results have been very helpful to them. They've been supportive of the match series. The Virginia HBPA is a member of the Mid-Atlantic Strategic Plan. The Virginia horsemen support every initiative that we've implemented in the region. They support the match series. They're not. They did not join as plaintiffs in the lawsuit. And then, interestingly, in West Virginia, the horsemen at Mountaineer are plaintiffs, but the horsemen at Charlestown are not. So I can't explain that dynamic at all. Wouldn't even attempt to do so. The horsemen in West Virginia even have been divided on their support for some of the Mid-Atlantic strategic initiatives. We've had support from Mountaineer and not from Charlestown. The Mountaineer horsemen have almost uniformly supported the Mid-Atlantic plan. We have issues on occasion with the horsemen of Charlestown who are opposed to some of the things we do. But, you know, that's just the way it is. And we do the best we can to build consensus. Remember, the Mid-Atlantic plan doesn't require anybody to do anything. That's a purely voluntary plan. But we very rarely run into groups that say no.
Well, I appreciate it, Alan. I wanted to, you know, I wanted you to verbalize the thoughts as we wait for, you know, the next steps here. You mentioned in part of the conversation here before I ask you about Match, you did mention the redevelopment plan happening for Maryland, and this has been something that you know you've worked for years and years, and certainly the COVID year, as it seems to be monikered now, you know, has delayed things. But give everybody an update on where things stand and when you know when groundbreaking and you know, some of the. You know, some of the actual physical work is going to get started.
Sure. So there's tremendous behind the scenes work that's being done, and it was always anticipated this year that that would be the case. There are numerous agreements that have to be drafted and entered into between any number of entities, groups, contractors, you name it, and a lot of what is going to happen here because the redevelopment plan is under the jurisdiction of the Maryland Stadium Authority. This is not the track operators who announce a redevelopment plan and then, you know, it ends up on the shelf because nothing happens. This was passed by state law, authorized to move forward under the guise of the Maryland Stadium Authority, who have an international reputation. They are simply terrific. And a lot of what has to be done with this plan has to be done through the state procurement process. So, for example, I was part of, obviously, the conceptual team that announced this, the possibility of this redevelopment plan. And we worked with architects in our conceptual design. But the Stadium Authority, through the procurement process, actually had to select the architect design team. And that was just done. That was a laborious process with bids that came in from across the world. I mean, international interest. And the design firm was selected. I'm happy to say that the firm that we work with when we put the conceptual plan together was the firm that won the award and is now actively working, doing site assessments, doing any number of things. There are other procurements that are taking place right now in any number of design, engineering, and other areas. The bond team is working because, you know, this is going to be financed through a sale of bonds by the Maryland Stadium Authority. That work is being done. So, and there's a team meeting talking about, you know, the transition. Where are we going to start? Are we going to start at Laurel? Are we going to start at Pimlico? We've got two racetracks that are going to be rebuilt, one backstretch completely rebuilt, and a consolidation of all of Maryland racing at one facility. And we got, you know, over 1,000 horses here. They're going to have to be relocated at some point while this construction takes place. So it's a massive, first of its kind, never done before project. And all the planning is taking place right now. I don't have any specific information, but I would expect to see some shovels go into the ground in 2022. I don't know that anything's going to happen this year. But, you know, we're only in March, so it's a little early in the process, and we'll let the architects and design team, the Strana Group, which is very actively involved with their people, Maryland Thoroughbred Horsemen, help to put this together. But it's happening, it's moving forward, and it's going to be one of the great parties when this is done and we get out of this COVID environment. I can tell you, it's going to be one hell of a party.
There's no doubt. And the work that went into it, the Maryland miracle, really. And We'll look forward to Preakness, even kind of a still a subdued Preakness, but it is ahead, and plus the Timonium sale, and things in Maryland continue to be really one of the bright spots. The whole Mid-Atlantic, really. Alan, finally, as part of that story, tell everybody about plans for Match for this year. Last year scuttled, not surprisingly, but you're going to get some sort of a little Match activity in this year.
Steve, it's dizzying with Match. It's one of those challenging things I've ever done because, you all the hard work you do, and there are always circumstances that seem to get in the way, and last year it was COVID, and obviously we were concerned about the survival of the industry. And the last thing we needed to worry about was funding a fun series, which is great, but we didn't know what racing was going to look like. And then when we got the regional partners together, we were going to expand the series this year to include Colonial and Charlestown, and we had some really cool things planned. But when the partners got together late last fall, it looked like things weren't going to significantly change in 2021 to the extent that we could bring the full series back together. And so we decided to continue the series on hiatus. And David Richardson, who is the dynamic executive director of Maryland Thoroughbred Horsemen, and who actually did the initial creative work for Match back in 1997, said, well, why don't we put a series together in Maryland and just run it in Maryland? And they worked with Sal Sinatra and Georgianne Hill and the folks at Maryland Jockey Club, put a proposed series together. I asked the regional partners, because the series really belongs to everybody, if they would oppose Maryland running a series. They supported it. And then the great folks at Colonial, Jill Byrne and her team, and Frank Petromalo at the Virginia HBPA said, well, the way you've got the series designed, we could run a match day here at Colonial. How about letting us in? And so we're going to announce a match series today. It's going to be Maryland and Colonial. It's going to start Preakness weekend and go until the 26th of December this year. We're going to stagger it out. Four dirt divisions for the girls and the boys, and 2.75 million in purses, all stakes, $282,000 in bonuses, and we're going to run a match series, but it's just going to run in Maryland and Colonial. That's great. It's
something. Yeah, exactly.
That's what they want to do.
Exactly. Just enough to just enough to keep it alive for come back next year and have a full fledged full execution that includes everybody in the parks.
Yeah, everybody's in. I mean, Delaware. Everybody wants to bring the series back, but you want to do it the right way. We've never done anything half-assed, and we are extraordinarily respectful of the financial constraints that everybody's been operating under since this whole COVID pandemic started. And it's just unfair to ask people to step to the plate now until things get back to normal.
Alan, for somebody that was supposedly paring back and arcing toward retirement, you seem as active as ever.
Sounds like the batteries have been recharged a bit.
hopefully that's contagious for everybody that listen, it's not unusual. Even without something like COVID, it's not unusual for some of the challenges of this sport and industry to to wear people down. This is there's challenges that are unique in this arena, and then you fold in what everybody had to deal with last year, and I've said already 1,000 times how miraculous the industry's response has been. And, the fact that literally by middle of last year, the industry had adjusted and really thrived under the most trying of circumstances. But whatever it takes to keep everybody upbeat and supportive of each other is really, central to you know, the game's continuity and even survival, I'm sure, in some people's minds. So if you're enthused, other people should take that as a sign.
The horsemen, we get criticized all the time. It goes with the territory. But the horsemen look to us to help them, okay? They want to be able to go to the track every day and train their horses and get their horses to the races. You know, the owners want to enjoy the business. And, you know, they look to us to try to, you know, maintain the strength of the industry. And they look to us for answers. And sometimes we have good answers. Sometimes we don't. Sometimes we screw up. Sometimes we do things the right way. As I've gotten around over the past few months and talked to people, I get a good feel from them. They're very appreciative of some of the things we're doing. I think that while certainly there would be some opposition to highs, I think people feel very good about that. They think that it's going to be helpful in the long run, and it's going to allow the focus to go back onto, you know, what we're so good at, and that's just putting on one of the great, you know, sporting events of any sport in the world. It's just exciting. And we've got great challenges going forward, tremendous challenges. But, you know, for me, I'm trying to train younger people to come in and take over so I can step back. I've done it for a long time, and I'm enthused about some of the young people coming in, you know, Joe Applebaum, Mike Ziegler, John Green, I could go down the list, Rob Masiello, guys who've gotten into the business here in Maryland, David Richardson, and some of the young trainers here. That's really important. Really, there's not many of my generation still standing or still involved in the business. You know, it's getting lonelier and lonelier for me. So I just want to be sure that we can hand it off to people who are going to, who really care about the business, are going to do right by it.
Alan Foreman, appreciate it as always. Comprehensive. I can budget for 40 minutes, and we always go 50% longer because there's too many important things to talk with you about. So I appreciate it as always.
It's fun. Thanks, Steve. Always enjoyed it.
Alan Foreman, everybody. Let's take a break, and we're gonna get tight here. I've got to get Sid in, and eesh. Yeah, let's take a quick break, Case. Real short, actually. I won't leave the station. Let's get Sid in because we've got Tony Alivato. Well, I'm pretty full in hour three, too. So I thought maybe just take this one break, right? This will be the only break of the day. Yeah, let's do that. All right, back after this, real quick.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Why, in the past decade, has BRL Equine become the premier equine supplement company in the industry? Because we spend millions in research and development before we ever put out a product. Because we use only FDA-supervised facilities to manufacture for us. Because what we say is in them is in them. Because they work. Because if you're not happy, I'll give you your money back. And because top trainers and veterinarians in thoroughbred racing, standardbred racing, three-day eventing, and barrel racing all trust in BRL Equine. Shouldn't you? To find out more how Flexify HA, Unlock, Bleeder Shield, and EPO Equine can help you, contact me, Joseph Vellante, 215-501-6880.
There's a great story to tell in Pennsylvania. Only three states have produced more Breeders' Cup champions, and no state can match our performance in recent years. Since 2016, our numbers of mares bred has skyrocketed, unlike the national trend. And this year's live foal report shows Pennsylvania up over 50%. Why? Our incentives and bonuses are the best in North America. Please visit us at pabred.com and see why Pennsylvania is the premier place to breed and race.
Sirius XM Sports presents At the Races with